Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Slacker Brigade, welcome to another award-winning podcast here on the Slacker Network. I can't keep that up, it uses too much breath. Hello Slackers, hope you're good. It is Phil Taggart. This is my podcast, it's the Slacker Podcast. It is a podcast all about music. It is all about incredible artists, and by God, we've had them over the last couple of years, and it starts off with their demo. So, you know, anybody who's listened to this loads of times, feel free to like skip forward like 30, 40 seconds, because you know exactly what this podcast is all about. Grabbing that early demo, picking up a part for 5-10 minutes at the start, and then just having a really insightful, interesting conversation with them, trying to ask the questions to artists that they don't normally ask, or sorry, get asked. Do you know what I'm saying? This podcast today is with Kurt Vile, and we will get to that in just a second, because mad love to the Patreons who are supporting the podcast, who are keeping the lights on at Slacker HQ, by which I mean the cabin out the back of my house. This cabin has been an absolute godsend over lockdown. There was kind of like nothing in it beforehand, and I've now stuck a PC into it, some recording equipment, and I'm getting the best out of it. There's been silver linings for being locked down, and the fact that we have been means that I've been recording loads of podcasts. I've got some really incredible records coming up. I just did Matt Berninger from the National last week. I have podcasts coming up from Bicep, from Tim Burgess, and maybe one or two other ones. I can't see them in my diary just at the minute, but I'm trying not to record as many as I have been, because at the minute I'll be like completely up to like 2022. Back to the Patreons, patreon.com/slackerpodcast, if you want to join the Slacker community, if you want to contribute to your favorite content and keep it going, then much obliged. You've heard the spiel a million times before, but it genuinely is like every time somebody new joins the Patreon, I'm like, yes, this is great. This is people showing that my podcast has some sort of value outside of just listening to it for free. So I really respect that. We've got Anna Gandolfo, God, that was a struggle, who's just joined, James Taylor, who's just joined, whether that's the artist or singer, I don't know, and Paul Easton, big up to those guys, and thank you to them for being Patreons of the Slacker Podcast. Today, the podcast that everybody is getting, Patreon or not, is Kurt Vile. Somebody whose music I've loved over the years. He was a very early member of the War on Drugs, but like only for a little bit. He, as a solo artist, has recorded some of the best records that I've ever listened to. Like honestly, like his last record, Bottle It In, was pretty good. And me and my missus were like absolutely obsessed with Waking on a Pretty Day. So here it is, Slacker Podcast with Kurt Vile in 3, 2, 1. Who's that in the background? Is that Charles? Who's that?
That's Charlie Pride.
Charlie Pride.
The greatest country singer there ever was. Well, actually, he still is. He's still amazing. But Cowboy Jack Clement discovered him and produced him. And I do a cover of Cowboy Jack Clement on the new record, which is called Gone Girl on the EP.
You know, like I was gonna get to like the Cowboy Jack bits later on, but listen, while we're here, like I was reading all about it today, and I'm so fascinated by Cowboy Jack, Fergie, the relationship that you had with them, the whole Jacksonville, the whole my mind's absolutely
Nashville.
Sorry, spot the Irish dude, right? And could you tell us a little bit about Cowboy Jack?
Well, I never met him personally, but because he passed away a little bit after I got to Fergie, who produced recorded this album, and who was Cowboy Jack's engineer for a long time. There's an amazing movie. This will tell you a lot you need to know about Cowboy Jack, but he's got a movie, sort of doc combined with movie, a lot of footage. He was making a movie his whole life, and it somewhat culminated into this documentary called Shakespeare Was a Big George Jones Fan. And you just see everybody in his corner, all the people he influenced or produced and played music with, everybody from Waylon to George Jones to John Prine to Charlie Pride to Johnny Cash, and others, so many others, and the songs that he's written that you didn't realize. But yeah, Jerry Lee Lewis is one of my favorites. He's a maniac. He's the killer. He's the one, like Jerry Lee Lewis, when he went to Sun Records in search for a record deal. Sam Phillips wasn't there. It was Cowboy Jack Clement, and yeah, so he was like the early guidance with Jerry Lee and engineered a lot of his records and things like that. That's, you know, I could jump around all, but he's got this solo record that Matt Sweeney turned me on to. Matt Sweeney, he's the one who knew Ferg, and this record, I'm spacing on the album title right now just to look like a total poser, but it's got the song Gone Girl on it. Mm. And it's just so good. It's out of print right now still, but I don't know. He's just got so many, he's just influenced so many people and had such a great production sound as well on the Stoneman Family and these Charlie Pride records. And he produced and engineered Dreaming, My Dreams, the Waylon record that I love so much.
Yeah.
I love all Waylon's records, but
so like it was a case of like this is somebody that you would love to have worked with, but like you ended up getting put in touch with his like protege, the person he brought up, Fergie, and then that's where you sort of took it from there.
I wouldn't say that exactly. Fergie was, you know, he owned the butcher shop with John Prine, which sometimes I knew and sometimes I forgot, but I just knew. Matt Sweeney told me the guy to know is Ferg, and you know, he's the one still, he's just like the real heart of like the Nashville country. I mean, somewhat outlaw, the whole outlaw thing in a way. You know, he's sort of the roots of country. I don't know.
Also, like, I mean, that the name of the recording studio that you do all that to, like, I mean, it's, I think it's closed down now, but it's moved out of town. The Butcher Shop. Like,
yeah, the Butcher Shop. Yep.
I mean, if you're going to cut a record and you're like talking to like somebody who maybe doesn't know the backstory to this, you're like, oh, I'm going for like 2 weeks to the Butcher Shop with your guitar on your back.
Well, that's sort of the beauty too, is with those guys, you don't do anything for 2 weeks. You go in for 2 days and you get just as much, you get like a solid live recordings, overdub if you need to, but all my parts are live with the band, just playing guitar and singing. And
Because that's what you get, isn't it? Like when you go in there, like it's a full band scenario. Like you got these like gritty old players that have played with everybody. Yeah. They're ready to go. Like, do you have to rehearse your song that much with them? Or like how intuitive is the whole process?
No, I think they just watch you run it down. And I keep it relatively simple. But I would say the last song on the EP called Pearls, it's an older song of mine. It's got a lot of time signature changes. And it took people... it blew some minds more than others, but we got it down still in a couple takes, you know? Yeah. So that's beautiful. But yeah, it's called the Butcher Shop because it's in an old, basically like a packing plant, you know, like a butcher shop. It's in an old warehouse where I guess they used to pack the meat. You know,
yeah. Is there stories of it being haunted by chickens, old guys?
Yeah.
There's a certain like magic of Nashville that I hear people talking about all the time. I mean, I don't know absolutely fuck all about the magic of Nashville because I've never been there. But like, right. What's it like for somebody like you who grew up around that, like with that music, sort of like it. Through osmosis, do you know what I mean? Like, what was it like going into Nashville and recording there and living there for a bit?
Well, I think that for me, I literally just record with the right guys, like the, you know, people who, like, Ferg had been recording with Cowboy Jack and others, you know, back with Towns Van Zandt and things like they're in this movie, Shakespeare was a George Jones band. Fan, there's a scene of Johnny Cash having a smoke laying on AP Carter's grave, you know, who was, you know, of the Carter family. You know, he married June Carter. He's like, I never got a chance to have a smoke with AP Carter. You know, I didn't get to know him that well. So he's like laying on his grave having a smoke. And I'm like, when I went into work with Ferg on the phone, I was like, man, I love that movie. I love that part where, Johnny Cash is smoking a cigarette on AP Carter's grave. He's like, oh yeah, Kurt, I filmed that, Kurt. We're gonna have a good time, Kurt. So, yeah, like the first song I wanted to record for the record before I went there was the title track or the pseudo title track, the John Prine song, "Speed of the Sound of Loneliness." And I was like, "You cool with that? You know that song?" He's like, "Oh, Inside and Out, Kurt. John's a good friend of mine. We're going to have a good time, Kurt." So that's what I was going for. I was going for, cause there's all kinds of facets of Nashville and there always has been. I respect them all, but I think, to try to get to the sort of gritty roots, is probably a little tougher now cause everybody's younger and there's, I don't know, but I found it. So.
Does it like mean that people like you have to like keep that like people of you and your like sort of ilk that like respect that so much have to keep that legacy going, I guess, because like those old guys aren't getting any younger, so like, you know, that sort of style of not even just music but like that sort of mentality around music, like is it important to keep that sort of tradition up?
Yeah, I think it is, for the people that if somebody is feeling it, you know, which I am, I think it's important to keep that going. And I think there's always going to be people. Yeah, it's a crazy digital world and that's just what it is. I mean, I like certain pop music, being that more than ever, I feel like now that I got young daughters and, but yeah, I do pride myself on, I've been sort of doing recording live, keeping it live as much as possible. Definitely I've always been influenced by people like Neil Young and Bob Dylan, who are all about being as playing as live as possible and as raw as possible. But then there's a whole other level when you get into the old country dudes or, and I don't know, just various books I read and people I listen to. Somewhere along the way, several years ago at this point, but I just sort of knew I want to just make it as raw and as live as possible. And you're surprised how not raw it comes off a lot of times because everybody's glued together because they played live and Pro Tools and things like that can really, it's a constant battle, like with the Pro Tools and all the options and the computer to not get bogged down and just basically get lazy and loop things together. And, you know, so, yeah.
I'm guessing you're not playing to a click track anytime soon. Like,
I mean, I'll do everything, but I've never liked the sound of like a computer click track, like punching me in the skull.
It's killer, isn't it?
Drum machine. Beep, boop. Boop, yeah, beep, boop, boop, boop. Yeah, I don't. Somebody did that to me once. I was like, no. But you know, there's all kinds of analog drum machines, or even you know, cool apps play drum machine, whatever. You know, there's all kinds of ways to get a beat pulse going if you don't have any instruments in the room.
You mentioned Dylan.
I mean, instrumentalists. I meant.
you
planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mentioned Dylan there, and like I think he dropped like his latest album. As if Dylan drops an album, like as if Dylan has
and
ever,
he did,
has ever said the words himself. I'm dropping my new album. But like, yeah, he did. He put out a new record, like what, at the age of 78 or thereabouts, and fucking hell, it was a really good record. Like, you just don't expect somebody of that age still to be able to continue that quality. Like, I mean, if you look at like the Stones, like, or even U2 or somebody like that, like, they haven't delivered in a long, long time, but like, Dylan still does.
Yeah, well, Dylan, he listens to all those same raw people. He always talks about keeping it raw, like the old blues guys. And I happened to see a couple shows at the Beacon Theater in New York and one in Philly. And I got inside scoop that they were making a record. They had just gotten like a new drummer. The rest of the guys have been in the band for a good amount of time, but the alchemy and chemistry on stage was undeniable. And then I heard through the grapevine that they were making a record, and I heard they made it fast. You don't know if that's a legend or not, but I'd imagine they did. But for me, that record was exciting also because I got really obsessed with Tempest not that long ago. And that's a similar record. Songs like Roll On John are about John Lennon, and there's all these Beatles references in there. You don't even get it at first. And I don't know if this is definitely like an answer to that record, but you know, the writing is so strong as usual. And I don't know. Yeah, it's a beautiful record.
He's the only artist that has released so many albums that you can compartmentalize them into different families. Like, you could have like three or four different Dylan albums that live in the one house.
Totally.
Like, yeah. There's actually probably a full street of them. If Dylan turned around, or like Neil Young, or one of the sort of the Holy Trinity turned around to you and was like, come play guitar with us on the road, would you drop would you drop everything of your own to go and do it?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, I'd at least do it for a little while, and it'd be amazing. I mean, all of a sudden I was like, I got to get my own shit done. I don't do that. But of course I would.
That is, I mean, I'm going to put that up there with the stupidest question that I'm going to ask.
No, today. I love that question.
No, but listen.
It's not every, you know, not, I wouldn't do that for everyone. You know?
No, big time. But
I wouldn't do it for the Stones, even though I love them. I'd be like, I don't know.
I don't think that the Stones play their instruments live. Like, I think that, like, I don't know, this is maybe conspiracy theory shit, right? But like, I just get the vibe that there's somebody behind a curtain there that's like playing along, and they're just sort of like marionetted out there, like doing their thing.
I think they're really playing. they're pretty they're definitely playing. I'm a huge Stones fan. I'm actually, you know, I would tour with them for a minute at least.
Yeah.
Just to see what happens.
Exactly. I wanna see, sort of like pull back the curtain and see what happens back there. You said you're like, your daughters are into pop music, and that's probably opened your ears up to like music you probably most definitely wouldn't have been listening to anyway. Like what has been shocking you, and like what has been sort of making you pass remark?
I have actually always liked pop music. You know, when I was younger, it was Hit Me Then, or like, there was all kinds of cool pop from when I was a teenager, like, or preteen, like, you could say Roxette. It's pop, but it had a rock in there. But for a while, I've been into, I think Miley Cyrus just gets more better and better all the time. I turn my daughters on to Miley Cyrus, actually. But I recently got into Kesha a lot, and I mean, I always heard her in the background, but I was listening to her for various reasons, and my daughters got super obsessed. So we've been listening to a lot of that. And another one that is in pop music now, but she's obviously comes from another place, is Kacey Musgraves. Mm. You know, she's in the pop charts, etc. She's a total pop star. She's just a star in general, but she's so musical. Obviously, she comes out of country that I feel like various things that were extra popular, which I would always see their names but not pay total attention to on a sliding scale of those people that I told you about. But I don't know, they're three of kind of my favorites right now.
Do your like kids talk to you on a sort of musical level about them, or like do you try and like sort of talk to them about going, well, this is good because of this or that or whatever? No, and their daughters are just like, shut up, dad.
they know, they're all totally musical. My youngest daughter is crazy musical. They both are musical. They both have play harp. My friend Mary Lattimore from Philadelphia, where I live, she doesn't live here anymore, but she got the girls interested in the harps, like a giant harp. Mary plays on several of my records, but when they were young, they got a little harp and they would take lessons. And then, so they both play the harp. But my youngest, she's a lot like me. She'll just go up to anything and play it, and she'll play all the instruments in the house before I have even gotten up. I can hear her going from the piano to the organ to my guitars to now she's picked up drums. So, and my older daughter is really super into music as well, but she's always listening closely to the lyrics, and she's big into pop. She loves Adele. Things like that. I don't know. Yeah, but no, they're very, they're homeschooled. They just have like a home education where if they're into something, they just get into it. They don't have somebody sort of telling them what and what to not learn. And I feel like music is almost just school. It's like a pure emotion also. It's just, we all love to listen to music, but it's another form of education, really.
It's a super, super healthy thing to be obsessed with, like as well.
Yeah.
Like your first like instrument wasn't the one you wanted, was it? Like you got a banjo instead of a guitar.
Yeah, well, that was my first string instrument. Yeah, I think I've told this story a lot of times, but it's still a good story. Is that like the year before they were going to give me a guitar, but I didn't know that. But I was wanting a guitar, but I was really bad that year. Or so they said. So they didn't give me anything, but they were like, we were going to get you a guitar, but you've been the worst this year. I'm paraphrasing. It's probably blown, you know, I'm having fun with it. But yeah, then the next year I got a banjo. My dad's a super bluegrass freak and old time music. So it's in my DNA, all the, you know, so it's cool to be playing with some of these sort of country legends now that I at least knew the people that I grew up listening to, like Hank Williams.
Yeah.
Somebody knew somebody who knew somebody who knew Hank Williams in my world, you know, or Johnny Cash, etc. That's the kind of stuff I grew up hearing. from my dad.
What's your chops like on the banjo now? Have you kept up with it? Are you still good? Because it is definitely one of those instruments you have to stay on top of, right?
Well, I've been playing guitar and finger picking and things like that for so long. I have a very sort of, it's sort of like an Appalachian, my own sort of style of some hybrid of an Appalachian style on the banjo. It's finger picking. It stays with you kind of forever. I mean, I get a little rusty for a second, but that's not the kind of music I play. It can be rusty, but I'm not going to like forget how to play it.
Yeah.
Like, so no, it's easy.
When you play with like legends like that, you tend to get like they'll know you for a certain thing. Like if you're like really good at finger picking, if you're really good at like lap steel, if you're like really good at that. Like when you were coming out of those like Nashville sessions, what do you think, other than your singing and songs, like what did they have you down as? Did they have you down as a certain style or a certain way of player?
I mean, they were all so awesome. I really don't think, they're all so laid back too. They're not like too, they're definitely not posh about anything. They're raw and hilarious dudes. And I think it's pretty cool because I think it's just, there's five songs, four of them are finger picked, I believe. Yeah, just finger pickers. And then the other one is a strummer. The singing, Pat McLaughlin, who was the only person who was on all five songs, blew my mind. And he took me in. He was super nice. He had our kids over to his farmhouse. And he complimented my singing. I don't think anybody's ever really complimented my singing, but I really am proud of my singing on this record. But anyway, Pat McLaughlin, he played with John Prine, you know, up until a little before the end. And he's just so soulful. He plays the mandolin and guitar and backup vocals on certain songs. And yeah, I made so many friends, and even the guys that I only knew from the session, I feel like we're friends. I can't wait to play with them again. So many legends. Dave Rowe, the bass player, and Bobby Wood is a legend, and Kenny Malone, the only drummer. He was like 80. He's getting up there. But yeah. He's like the only drummer. He asks you to see the lyrics so he can play along, so he can vibe to the lyrics and things like that.
I like that. Like that's like that is definitely feeling the vibe of the song. There's no necessary need for him to do that, but that's just what sets him apart, I guess.
He would disagree with you.
Listen, those guys know a lot more about what they do than I do. I could just I could sit back and enjoy it. Like that's all I got for that. What was it like playing with John Prine?
That was great. I had played with him a few times on stage, and to finally have him come into the studio was incredible. I knew, because I think it was three installments of getting this EP done over a couple year, you know, and it would literally just be a couple days, 3 days max. I would go in with Ferg, and I came back to finish the EP with Ferg, like mix it, I guess, and see John Prine on New Year's Eve at the Grand Ole Opry. It's the second time I came to Nashville to see like celebratory John Prine gigs. The first time I also revolved around a session, and that was when he turned 70 and he played two nights at the Ryman. But anyway, this time was New Year's Eve, this past New Year's Eve at the Opry. And I just knew when I got there to Ferg, we were mixing, we just had the four songs. I sort of knew, I was like, well, this EP will have a whole lot more weight if we can get John in here to play this song. And there was also another level where I was just planning to go there and finish the EP and mix it and go see the show. But then I got asked to play with Prine at the Opry, because a really good friend of mine, Eileen, she works for John's label, and also John's wife, Fiona. They all took me in, and Prine's bandmates and his family, his son Jody and things, it's a family affair, and they run the label. So I was asked to play with them, and I was, at first I was like, man, I'm nervous. I just wanted to see the show and finish the EP. But then obviously it made more sense. I was like, and I just told Ferg, I was like, this EP would have some more weight if we get John in here to teach me this song and then we can record it. And then, you know, this EP will mean a lot more with have John on there. There's already a John Prine cover, you know, so yeah, he just came in and acted like it always happens. But really, I play with him on stage a few times in my life, like, which is a country thing to do. And it was always great. I was always nervous. But when he came in, he was like, yeah, you know, I love to sing with you, Kurt, as if we talk all the time or something, as if it's normal. So it was amazing.
It's like, something out of one of those like old Johnny Cash specials that you would see, that like somebody would come up on stage and they'd be like going, you know, like they're literally best friends.
Yeah, I love. That's why I love country music in general, because everybody's so into the music. There's no deep down, like you could be doing it on the porch. Like everybody's just loving the music, and I feel like that's just a soulful thing. You know, it's definitely has southern roots often, or like country. You know, like literal in the country kind of roots. I like how Chris Christopherson said in the country music doc that just came out recently, he's like, oh, I like country music is sort of like soul. I feel like it's sort of like soul music for white people. That's not saying obviously anybody can be involved, but there is a soulful thing there. It kind of came from the fields in that way. So, I don't know.
With country music, like it, unless it's in the family house growing up, it's not necessarily something that teenagers get into by themselves. It's something you either get into like when you're before a teenager or after. Like you can't do you see what I mean? Like what were you listening to when you were a teenager, when you were sort of coming of age?
Yeah, when I was a teenager, I was listening to I feel lucky because there was cool, weird stuff coming out. There was definitely some crap too that I look back at that I shouldn't necessarily liked, but there was also this raw kind of cool thing happening, like the early Beck and obviously like Dinosaur Jr. And so I was into the Smashing Pumpkins and things like that, like anybody else. I still respect Smashing Pumpkins, but like I like the things that were like a little more screwed up combined. But anyway,
yeah, like
sorry, what?
Like the stuff from that label, Drag City.
Yeah, definitely all that stuff really opened my mind, and all those people that were making already weird stuff, but it was accessible to me, you know. Yeah, like the Palace Brothers Appalachian stuff, and like it was Appalachian, but it was in your kitchen, in a, you know, in a kitchen. I could just see it being made. But my dad was still playing. Yeah, so I would pretend maybe that I didn't like all my dad's bluegrass all the time, but I love it all now. And I would admit I love stuff then. It was undeniably catchy, but yeah, you can't always admit you like it as a teenager. But there were certain things like Doc Watson, he would always play, and he was playing more guitar. And I was like, oh, I like him because he's playing guitar. A little later, he started playing the folk anthology and Charlie Patton and Bullweevil Blues and Mississippi John Hurt, those things like hit me right away. Yeah, so
what about the Philadelphia scene? Like what was that like? Like did you have bands that you could go watch? Did it inspire you to start playing in bands or start playing live?
There was a scene in Philadelphia that friends of mine would go to a lot in West Philly called Stalag. A lot of punk bands would be playing, and I was loosely had a foot in that scene. I would go and play my banjo. Actually, I had some ridiculous stuff, you know, or coffee houses and things like that. That was one outlet, or people would have house shows in my teens. And then there were some bars I could play that, you know, I could get in underage. But I would say I didn't tap into any real scene in Philly and where people would come to a bar and actually book me to play or something until my early to mid 20s, you know. There were all kinds of things going on in Philly, sort of, but it wasn't till like my late 20s that I put out records. So there's a lot of local gigging going on.
Like, what were those like early gigs like for you? Were they something that you enjoyed doing? Was it something that you had to sort of pushed on stage to do? Like, I mean, like you
don't. Oh, I love that. I always wanted to play on stage. I feel like there were 2 years where I moved up to Boston and I didn't know anybody up there. I knew some people, but I didn't play any gigs up there. I kind of woodshed, and that's where I started recording at home a lot, kind of psychedelic music, and got good at finger picking. But when I came back from Boston, it was in 2003. I was 23, and from 2003 through 2007 or 8, there are tons of gigs. I was always hustling to get gigs, putting up flyers all over town, and I feel like my mind, I would like set a goal. I would never. It's not like I was like, I want to tour the world. I'd be like, oh, I got to get to this club. Okay, now I got to try to get in at this club. It's like kind of a almost suburban version of Bob Dylan hustling in the streets of New York, you know, very. But I don't know. But I guess my mid to later 20s, people like Jack Rose and Meg Baird were playing truly authentic folk music and but they're actually putting out records and Meg was on Drag City actually. So, with Espers and her solo records and yeah. So there was a legit stuff coming through, after a certain point, even before I finally had records out.
When did you and Adam hook up?
That in 2003, he was one of the first people I met actually.
So was that, you just came back on, back off the bus from Boston into Philadelphia and he's just waiting for you at the depot with a bunch of flyers and a guitar.
a friend of mine, Joe Badia, he got me a job at the brewery, Philadelphia Brewing Company, where I worked my first job. And it was his roommate. So he introduced us and we were both, I was obsessed with Dylan. Like extra obsessed. I was like reading all these books. It was my first deep obsession of Dylan. I always liked him, but then I was super. And then I saw that he had like the same books and like he had that Clinton Halen Dylan recordings book. He let me borrow it right away. I couldn't believe I could talk all this information with somebody, like let it out, you know? And he knew everything I was talking about. And yeah, so he joined my band, The Violators, in maybe 2004. One of the clubs I was hustling to play all the time was called The Fire, and he gave me like a residency. So I put a band together, and he was on bass, and then also the War on Drugs, an early version of the War on Drugs played too. I feel like the War on Drugs went through a few incarnations, where once they were sort of like a conventional sort of rock band. And then he went on tour with another band called the Capillaries, and I got deep into my psychedelic home recordings again. And he came back, and then around 2005, there was this whole other sort of organic thing going with psychedelic music combined that we were woodshedding on in his house, and we took a week off of work, and we recorded just a bunch of my music, which was like songs that made the first Matador record, like
was it Constant?
Blackberry yeah. Song. No, this is like the first Matador record, and then Overnight Religion, and then a little after then in 2005, started booking War on Drugs shows again, and I joined again, and it was this whole other psychedelic thing, and I think, and that was cool. That was, I'd say, from 2005 to 2008. We were in each other's bands. And then after that first War on Drugs record came out in 2008, then I left the band and I managed to hang on to Adam in the Violators until 2011 or so. And
you still pop up on Slave Ambient though, don't you? Like, cause your name is on it.
Yeah. That was like, I was kind of all in awe and relieved that Adam stayed in my band because I needed him. Just the fact that when Smoke Ring for My Halo came out, I assumed he was just gonna do his own thing, but he was into that record. He's like, hey, I'll tour with this record. Eventually he had to leave. And just from all that, I remember I was just like, hey, well, if you want me to play anything on Slave Ambient, let me know. And I'm stoked. I love that record, Slave Ambient.
Yeah, me too. I think it's my my favorite of theirs. Like,
in a way, it's mine too. They're all great, obviously.
Yeah.
But there's like a, I don't want to say favorite, but there's something about that record. It's very hypnotic and psychedelic. And
I had that record. I listened to it like when I moved to London for the first time. So I was like moving to London, had nowhere to live. And I remember like listening to it when I touched down. And then when I've always had this like real fucking weird relationship with that record now, that like every time I fly into London I have to put it on, and I have that sort of like goosebumpy feeling or whatever.
That's cool.
Yeah. And I don't have that with many records. It's not like I have like a record for every scenario or whatever, but like I guess like important parts of your life, like moving to a big town or somebody passing away or something like that, you kind of always remember what was playing.
Yeah, it triggers memories. That's the other thing about music in general, you know. That's a pretty, it's like something that can just like give you chills and like trigger memories and take you back, transport you back, all those things.
Is there a certain track that like can beam you back to a certain place? Is there something like,
so many that it's hard to isolate one right now, but I will say my Airplane record for the past year or so had been, I've actually, the newest Springsteen Western Stars, you play that in headphones and it's like an adult record, but I think it's my favorite record of his in years, actually. And it's like a more grand style of hypnotic and stuff, but I love that record.
Did you see Springsteen's Broadway shows?
I saw one. Yeah, it's great.
I'd love to have seen it. No, there's not a better storyteller in terms of like actually telling stories on stage than not just in his music. Like you could say that there are better storytellers out there in music. Like, not that many, but actually, from him just sitting down at a microphone and speaking, like I think there's he's kind of got it.
He's the boss.
Exactly, he's the boss. there was, yeah. Oh, yeah. I wanted to talk to you because, like, one of the things that, like, probably didn't really cross your minds too much when you were like jumping from doing some like guitar work with War on Drugs and Adam was coming in and playing in the Violators. And then for some reason, like years later, because both of you become successful and there's like eyes on both of your records, I'm not sure if it's journalists or just like social media or whatever, but they kind of tried to turn like you not being in each other's bands into like a thing, into like, you know, there'd be an animosity or fear or whatever. And that's just simply not true. Like that just never happened. It feels like it was just like a sort of constructed thing, really.
Yeah, I don't even know. It's so old. That's like an old thing to hear at this point. I don't know. Honestly, I feel like we were both members of each other's band, but not even in the way that somebody can make a story about a few. Like we're like best friends. We both, we kind of could really lock in with each other. And yeah, it wasn't like some Guns N' Roses kind of story or something where you could be like,
you know. That's what people are always looking for, isn't it?
Yeah.
When it comes to playing live, like you've supported some of the greats. You've played like all over the world, playing your own headline shows. Like you've kind of done what every musician sets out to do. In terms of like opening for a huge artist that you respect, like what ones like sort of stick out in your head?
Well, I opened for Prine and I sat in on stage with him. I've sat in with him multiple times. I sat in with him. We did Speed the Sound of Loneliness at the Harley Strictly Bluegrass Festival, which is my favorite festival in San Francisco in Golden Gate Park. And I had literally finished the last final note of my set with Courtney Barnett. We were there doing that when we put out that record, and I like jumped on a golf cart with three bottles of beer and like they zoomed me to the stage, and it was like midway through John Prine's set, and I got on stage and played that song. And I spun like a bobblehead on the stage, like completely like freaked out. But anyway, there's some footage of that. That's a great performance. But yeah, as far as opening, I opened for Neil Young with Promise of the Real. Biggest show we've ever played by far in Quebec, Canada. And it was like in front of like, I forget now, 80,000 people or something for some summer fest. Who else have I opened? I've opened for a lot of my teen heroes, like who have become friends of mine, you know, like Dinosaur Jr. And I've toured with Jay a lot and we've played together in the studio, things like that. And
I got to sit in on an interview with Jay Maskus when I was just starting out, when I was like maybe about 20. And I was writing for a magazine and it was like the first feature. And I was like, can I listen? I just want to hear him speak. and my friend was doing the interview and all I remember is like he would take the longest pause between words. So it would be like, so. My guitar pedal. Go on like that. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what kind of mood he's in, but
I enjoyed it. I thought that was fucking. I thought that was ace. I suppose like flipping the question around really is like, who's the best opener that you've had on tour with you or play before you? Have you ever had like somebody that's like kind of been so good that you've been like, oh god, this is gonna be fucking.
Well, my manager is awesome in that. He knows like when we tour, like he knows about getting a solid bill. So even if I'm in and out of focus, all of a sudden I'll get obsessed with somebody. But more recently, yeah, people like Kate LeBon, she's so amazing live. She's so amazing anyway, but the live show, we tour with her. Who else? Steve Gunn, he was an early opener. He's always amazing. Man, it's hard to think about. It's hard to even connect those dots. You know why? Because we're all like here in quarantine.
Yeah, exactly. Actually having a live show.
It's hard to imagine.
You played Willie Nelson's Picnic.
That was incredible.
I was thinking about that. Like, I was like, I wonder how much weed he paid him in.
Yeah, I didn't smoke any of that. My family was with me and it was during a time when there's a lot of times where I don't smoke weed, and actually smoking it, I could tell I'm sort of allergic. I get achy pretty quick, but eating weed when I can handle it just a little bit, I just need a tiny bit. And it does take me back to like my teens where music sounds amazing and things like that. I'll look at around the room and be able to like set things up nice, you know, which I wouldn't do if I wasn't a little stoned, you know, I don't know. But anyway, the Willie thing was amazing. We actually did that cover of Roll On John, the song I mentioned by Bob Dylan from Tempest. I did it with Promise of the Real, who's, you know, that's Willie's son, Lucas. And sometimes Micah is in the band as well. He has his own band. But so anyway, they backed me up on that song and Pretty Pimpin', and that was a surreal moment. I didn't meet Willie then. I met him briefly at an Outlaw Fest, it was called, but only like a handshake. But that was before I was a fan of Willie, but I've since gotten really deep. I was probably affected, honestly, by being on that ranch. I mean, I know I was. I played that show, and that's when a couple days later, next thing you know, I'm opening for Prime at Philly and playing Sam Stone on stage with him. And he's like dedicating a song to my dad. Wow. Things like that.
I mean, it's crazy. Like, I mean, you're ticking, like with that, all that happening so fast, you're like ticking too many bucket list boxes. Like, and you know, you need to like spread them out a little bit.
Well, that was a good time for that. Cause I was sort of like making my record and that was, I had finished. It was like the second to last time I had thought I was finished mixing my record. My last full length album, whatever that's called. I forget now. Bottle It In. I was at with Rob Schnapp in California mixing songs like the title track Bottle It In, which is one of my favorite songs I've ever done. But and then we had this grand plan to, I would then I would drive to Palm Springs. I met my family there, my wife, Suzanne, and my daughters, Awilda and Delphine. And then we drove from Palm Springs through Arizona, New Mexico, to Marfa, Texas, down through, you know, we stopped all these places on the way, and then drove to Willie's Ranch, played that show. I got really obsessed with Terry Allen, another outsider country legend. I don't know. That was a good time for all that kind of, it was combining bucket list with, but not too many. I wasn't on the road constantly then, so it was nice.
Like, when you have made as much music as you have, I don't know how many albums, like 8 albums, is it?
I think 8. And maybe, EPs, just as many EPs, maybe.
A ton of EPs. It seems like there's more EPs. It got me thinking, is there ever a moment where you have music that's just floating around that isn't already on an EP, an album, or destined to be on?
I got lots.
Yeah.
I got a lot now, because that's kind of what we do. We just kind of record. And I've gotten good at, I should say I know better now, like not to obsessively listen to things until it's time to get back into them. And case in point is this EP, this Nashville EP. It's amazing. Like in your head, sometimes you forget that something's good, or I thought the people would scratch their head. And I still think they would, had I not waited this long and gotten that Prime recording. If it came out any sooner, I feel like people would be scratching their head, because it does have a little bit of a twang to it, you know, like Kurt's country record. But listen to it now, I'm prouder than ever. And I think it's just super musical. There's all kinds of EPs, et cetera, stuff for the new record. And I'm getting my home studios fine-tuned all the time. So you gotta keep busy. And then in a lull like we're at right now, you got time to.
Does that make you freak out about next year? Like, because like obviously they're just gonna be so. It's like, you know, the Three Stooges, and they're all running to like get through the door, but like they all get stuck in the door and they can't get through it at all. I feel like that's what it's gonna be like with like releasing records and releasing music and touring next year, is that every band and every artist is going to be putting stuff out all at the same time.
Well, yeah, that's true, but I don't know, we're gonna have to see what happens. In general, we all got to be safe, and it's pretty disorienting world out there in general. It feels really good to be able to put this out, and honestly, and not have to do the same old grind of, I don't know, I could just put out music for music's sake. It's kind of new. And meanwhile, I'm trying to keep working on music at home. And it's been a long time since I could just be at home. But, you know, that's not saying it's real sad what's going on in general.
Yeah,
you know.
Totally, man. Well, listen, like I can't wait for the rest of the world to hear this beautiful EP that you're putting out, because I got a sneaky listen to it like last week, and I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much. Yeah,
I think people are gonna dig it. I mean, they always do with your stuff. Like,
not always. Not everybody.
Not everybody, but most people. Well, I think this is gonna be a special EP anyway. Thank you so much for giving me your time and coming on the podcast and chatting to me about it. And I'm sure I'll say thank you to you. On behalf of all of the Kurt Vile fans that are listening and watching this.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been great.